Okay, welcome back to CSE52 or CS50. Week 9, we're going to be covering some ways to further develop our skills in putting together websites. This time we'll be introducing some tools which will allow us to create more dynamic websites than we've used previously. Tools which we'll be using include JavaScript, which is another programming language that's a sort of closely tied with web design, much in the same way that PHP is, but with some marked distinctions. We'll also be exploring the document object model, which is a data structure that's closely related to how web pages are stored and individual page elements are maintained by the browser that you're using when you're accessing a web page. And we'll also be talking about AJAX, or asynchronous JavaScript and XML, which is an extremely useful tool for creating what we're used to seeing in a modern website, that sort of user experience where you're able to dynamically pull in information from other websites without actually refreshing your page. So let's go ahead and just talk about the development of interactivity, which we've seen as we've worked on web design over the past week. So we started out just focusing on HTML, which is it's the most basic building block that we have in our toolkit for creating basic web pages. All pages that we see on the web break down essentially to this HTML formatting, which essentially marks up the content we're going to see on the page. The browser interprets this and displays it to us. But with only HTML, all we can really create are these static, boring web pages, sort of like the sort of things we saw in the 90s. Just the most as sophisticated as it gets is forms and buttons that you can click on to send information to other pages. It's not all that interesting. You can't with HTML, all you can really do is create pages of the same caliber as you might have seen on like GeoCities or something back in the day. So then we introduced the idea of dynamically generating web pages so we can sort of customize the content. So for example, if we have a user logging into an account and they have specific information which is associated with their account, maybe a username, we can pull in that information while we're generating the page and then sort of inline that into the content of the HTML so we're able to display that to the user by generating this page with that content already placed within it before passing it to the browser. And all this happens on the server side. So with JavaScript, we're not only able to dynamically generate a web page, we're able to create a web page which actually has dynamic content. So the content itself can change. And what this means is that we're able to pass a page which actually includes code as part of that web page. So previously we were using a programming language, PHP, so code was involved, to create a web page, but that code was never accessed by the user. The server always executed the PHP. You recall when we learned about Chmod and setting permissions for our files, a PHP file was always set to 600, which meant that we could read or write it, but the user couldn't really do anything with it. They only got to access its output, which is what the HTML page that was created by our PHP interpreter after we ran the PHP file through it. So with JavaScript, we're actually passing all of our code as part of the HTML file, and it's being run by the browser instead. So JavaScript, what is it exactly? It's a programming language, like I've said, that we use in web design for creating dynamic web pages. Unlike PHP, the code is executed client-side, so as opposed to being a server, being interpreted server-side, the client actually executes the code itself, so the user's browser. And JavaScript code is included in the HTML that's passed to the browser. It's actually, if you pull up the source code for an HTML page and it includes some JavaScript in something like Chrome or Firefox, you'll be able to see all of the code that's been included on the page and which is being executed by your browser. So just to visually show how JavaScript relates to PHP, since this is the other programming language we've used in discussing web design. PHP and JavaScript are both interpreted languages, so to review what exactly that means, this is as opposed to C, which is a compiled language. An interpreted language is one that is not where you write your program by typing up the source code, and then when it's executed, it's not passed to a compiler before it's run. We don't actually have this step where we're compiling. The source code is just interpreted at runtime. So what this means is that an interpreter looks at the code you wrote and then immediately does something with each line as it reads it in. So this is what happens with PHP, and so does it happen with JavaScript. So when you open up the source in your browser and see this code, it's being interpreted on the fly at runtime by your browser to create the user experience that you get. PHP and JavaScript are both also loosely typed as opposed to strictly typed, which C is. And again, reviewing last week, this just means that you don't have to assign a particular data type to any variable that you're going to use. So if you create some variable x in JavaScript or $x in PHP and assign it some numerical value like a 5 or a 6 or a 3.14, and then decide later you want to store a string in it, like banana, monkey, apple, whatever you like, that's fine. You don't have to tie yourself down to any one particular data type. This can be changed. And the primary distinction between PHP and JavaScript, other than some syntactical details that we'll discuss as we go, is that PHP, once again, is executed on the server side, while JavaScript, rather, is executed on the client side by your web browser. Okay, so how do we actually write JavaScript code? How do we include it in the HTML file, which is what I've claimed we're able to do? Well, like CSS, which you'll recall we can include in style sheets, which are in a separate file, or else simply inline in the style attributes for our tags within our HTML code, JavaScript may be included either within the contents of the HTML page or in an external JavaScript file, a .js file, much like we used a .css file for cascading style sheets, and then linked into the page externally. That's actually very easy to do and is actually very beneficial because it means you can include all your code that you want to use for a website that uses JavaScript in some separate file and then link it into any page that's going to use it. And this saves you the trouble from having to put all that code in each of the pages that's going to use it if you have functions that are used across your website, much in the same way that you'd create a set of functions in a header library or something like that and then link it into different files in a C project. This can be very helpful for saving space and also making maintenance a lot easier on your website if you want to change these functions later. Linking in is as simple as including a script tag within the head of your web page. So you open up a script tag, source, this attribute is set to the name of your JavaScript file, so file.js in this case, file.js being some arbitrary file contained in the same directory that contains some JavaScript code, and then just end the script tag and end your header. So by including this, any functions which you wrote in the file file.js are now accessible to this HTML page and can be executed by the browser. Any questions so far? Okay. For the purposes of our examples today, we won't be using this because it's easier for me to demonstrate the JavaScript code if you can see it alongside the HTML it's working with. But just know that you can do this, and in a lot of cases, it's going to make your projects a lot cleaner and more manageable. So do keep in mind that you have this very simple way of linking in external JavaScript available to you. Okay, so let's talk about some of the bare bones of programming in JavaScript. So some of the things we can do. So obviously, we want to be able to deal with variables, and that's really simple. If we want to initialize some variable, make it a global variable, we can just write x equals 5. Again, this is a loosely typed language, no need for any fancy keywords to initialize a variable. Just give the name of the variable and then assign it to some value, and we can immediately start using it. And also no need to specify a type or anything. Note that variables in JavaScript are global by default. And if you want to initialize a variable to be local, you actually have to specifically say var x. So there's a need to include this var keyword if you want to refer to a variable, which is local in scope as opposed to being global. Data types in JavaScript, we have number, Boolean, string, object, undefined, and null. So note that number is just a generic number type. We don't specify any difference between a float or an int or a double or anything like that. We just have numbers, so if you have some numerical object value you want to represent, the data type of your variable will end up being number. Boolean for true-false values, string for, well, strings, self-explanatory, sequences of characters. An object, which is sort of like a struct. If you'd like to learn more about object-oriented programming, you can join me on Friday for my crash course in Java seminar, which will be focusing on an introduction to object-oriented programming. But for now, just know that an object is very similar to a struct in C, except that you can also include some additional behaviors which are unique to objects, which at least C itself is not able to support. Undefined, which is somewhat similar to null, but just used within different contexts, it's not incredibly important for us to really examine the distinction between those two for now, for our purposes. Just know that those two data types are distinct from each other and they may arise in certain circumstances, just so that you are aware of their existence. Okay. So moving on, we also have access to some handy operators in JavaScript, which will tend to be very useful for us. We have a concatenation operator, which joins two strings. So, for example, if I were to write in JavaScript something like str1 plus str2 and assign this to some variable x. So x equals the string str1 plus str2. What gets placed in x? Yeah.
Str1, str2.
Yeah, so it's just the string str1, str2. So where this string ends, we continue with it being this string. So we're essentially just taking the ends of these strings and sticking them together, concatenating them, and the concatenation operator allows us to do this very easily. So this is sort of demonstrating a lot of the power of JavaScript right out of the box. If we wanted to do this in C, it'd be a little more complicated. We'd have to allocate a large enough buffer. So if this is of size n, this is of size m, it'd be n plus m plus 1 or minus 1 if we're counting in n and m the null terminator. So one more thing we need to worry about. Great. Then we'd have to copy all of these characters in the beginning of that buffer, then keep track of where we are now, and then copy all these characters there. And it's a bit of a mess. But in JavaScript, yeah?
Or call strcat.
Or we can call an existing function which does all this for us. But in JavaScript, it's actually available just as part of the language and as a tool available within the syntax. And it's not even something that you have to think about. You can just go ahead and do it. Right. We also have available an equality operator, which is should seem very familiar to you. You should be used to using it in many of the conditions that you've written throughout the course this semester. The equality operator in JavaScript is a little more sophisticated in that it can compare across types. So for what do I mean when I say it can compare across types? Why might that be useful to us? Okay, so what are two types that we've kind of always wanted to be able to compare, but we're a little tricky? Okay, so suppose we have some representation of a number which is being passed in by the user. Since the user is restricted to typing on a keyboard, they can only really enter chars, which represent digits. So if the user wants to give me the number 123, well, what I end up getting from them is 123 in a string. And I want to see if they gave me the number 123. So I'm comparing it to the number 123. Does this work in C? Not really. It's kind of a problem because we're trying to compare a string to an int, and that doesn't really fly. Fortunately for us in JavaScript, it does. We play it a little more fast and loose with our equality operator, and if we see this string which represents the number 123, and we compare it to the number 123, it notes, okay, well, the data types aren't really the same, but we'll let it go this time. And every time, actually. So if you want to compare some text value which represents a number to some actual numerical value, you can do that in JavaScript. So you might be a little worried because, well, what if I don't want to compare across types? What if I want to know that these are both integer values and make sure that they're the same in every way? Well, you can do that as well. We have a stricter equality operator, which is just three equal signs. And this will only return true if the two values are not only the same value, but also of the same data type. So in this case, it'd only be true if this were actually a number 123 and this were a number 123. Any questions about the distinction between those two operators or why this is convenient and helpful and great? Okay, great. So since we are, we just talked a little bit about the importance of distinguishing between these data types as it relates to these two distinct operators. If you just want to find out what data type the value currently stored in some variable is, since we have said before that you can't really make any guarantees about it because after you create a variable, anything can be put in it. It's not strictly typed. You can use this type of operator. And for example, if I wanted to get the type of some variable x, I could just write type of x. And if x contains 7, this is going to return to me number. So it'll tell me whatever data type is currently stored in that variable. Any questions about that? Okay. This material is a little dry. We just need to power through the syntax of JavaScript so we can do something more interesting in it within a few minutes. But do raise any questions if you have any, since this is the foundational stuff we're going to be using. Okay. Let's keep going then. Oh, this is sort of a very interesting syntactical tool that you might not think to explore, but which is actually really helpful and can help you write more intuitive code. So suppose we have some array of strings that contain all the days of the week. So weekdays contain Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So it's an array containing these 7 strings. So normally if I wanted to iterate through each of these days of the week, I'd write a for loop like this. It looks very much like what I'd do in C. So I write for int I equals 0. I'm creating this counter variable. And then I have a condition I less than 7. So I execute while I is less than 7. And then my update, i++, every time I'm done, increment i by 1 each time. And then I'm not actually doing anything in this loop, but I'm just expressing this value weekday as I. So the first time I iterate through this, this is Sunday. The second time, it's going to be Monday, then Tuesday, et cetera, et cetera. So this loop, which I've placed on the right side of the slide, actually does something exactly equivalent in JavaScript. And what's happening here is we're creating implicitly this local variable, var day. So it's a local variable because I've preceded it with this keyword var. And I've written for var day in weekdays. So for each local variable day, which we find in the array weekdays, so we're essentially iterating through the different values in our array and storing each one in sequence in this local variable. And then I'm just expressing day here, which, since I've said these examples are equivalent, must be equivalent to weekdays I. So rather than explicitly referring to a particular element by number using this counter variable, I'm able to just assign each element in order until I get to the end of the array to some local variable, and then use it by just referring to that local variable. So it's sort of some nice syntactic sugar which is available to us in JavaScript, which makes our lives just a little bit easier. Any questions about this notation or how it works? Okay. So let's back out of here for just a moment and take a look at an actual example in JavaScript. So, all right, we seem to have a... let me go ahead and clear this out for a second. I didn't change the demo since last time I ran it. Okay, so what I'd like to do is... it seems like I have a function here which allows me to... alert the user when they've clicked in the body. Ignore that for just a second. So what we're seeing here is we have this body tag, which is contained within an HTML file, and I've set up this attribute called onClick. So that suggests we're going to do something when the contents of this body is clicked by the user. And it just contains some body text right now, so just something to fill in the space that's just labeled body text for simplicity. So if I were to write something like alert, and you clicked the text. Yay. So I can write a command here in JavaScript, alert being a command which brings up an alert window, which everyone should be very used to seeing on the web. And essentially, this is setting up a handler which is going to see, well, it's going to execute when we click. So it's just saying this attribute that contains information about what code we'd like to execute if this gets clicked, and then presumably that is what will happen when we click on that. So let's take a look at this example and see if that's indeed what happens. Okay, so we click the text. Yay, that's great. It seems to work fine. All right, so how is this working exactly? We have this arbitrary code which is included in an attribute, but that code is just a string that's contained within the HTML file. So how is this working that the page knows to execute that code when I click? It seems like it's just plain text is there. Why do we have this dynamic behavior all of a sudden? All right, so it's a little magic that's happening with the JavaScript interpreter. And what it's relying on is the idea of having events. Does this sound familiar to anyone, the idea of events? Well, it should be familiar to you, because if you think all the way back to week zero when we were toying around with Scratch, it seems like maybe that seems a little simplistic at this point in the course after we've dealt so much with C and dug into memory management, really gotten under the hood and gotten our hands dirty. But Scratch is actually a surprisingly powerful tool if you revisit it now. You might remember the idea of these events which you could broadcast. You might have thought of them as radio messages when you were playing around with the puzzle pieces in Scratch all those weeks ago. And what you can do in Scratch is at some point in your code, somewhere in one of your scripts, broadcast an event, and then somewhere else in your code, have that trigger some other puzzle pieces and have them execute at that time. So what you're able to do here is sort of escape through the normal flow of control and add some asynchronicity to your code, which allows sort of, you to branch off into another thread and have this code executing simultaneously while you're doing something else while still maintaining your normal flow of control. So essentially what's happening here is you're setting up an event handler. So what an event handler is something that's set up to listen for an event, so something that happens, that usually some interface option that's like selected by the user, and then just to sit around and know that it should execute some code whenever it notices that that's happening. So this is happening in the background all the time. It's just waiting for the opportunity to execute this code. And eventually, that event is triggered, and then this code is run. So for the example we just looked at, is we set up an onClick event for a tag, which does something when the content of the page is clicked by the user. And in this case, what we had execute was this code here written in JavaScript, which says, alert, you click the text, yay. So it calls the function alert, and then display. What that does is displays the argument message in one of those alert windows on the screen as soon as this is clicked. So when the JavaScript parser first looks through this file, when the page is loaded, it sets up an event handler, which is then triggered whenever the user clicks on the page. And this is all done through these HTML attributes contained throughout the tags on the page. Okay, so that shows us how we can sort of inline this JavaScript code right in the tags. You'll note that we can also include up here some JavaScript code near the head of the page, sort of placing it near the top rather than scattering code throughout the rest of our file. So I've created here apparently a function called do the same thing, which calls alert, and which also replicates the functionality that we just implemented. So let's try that then. Let's see if we can call a function from within here other than alert, a function we ourselves have written that doesn't come with JavaScript. Okay, so if we right here, do the same thing, and then save this, go back to the page, refresh it, and click on the body text, and it does in fact do the same thing. The function is aptly titled, and just to prove that I'm not pulling a fast one on you, if I open up the page source, just like I promised previously, all of this source code in JavaScript is available to the user to look at. It's contained right in the HTML page. Nothing is hidden, and we can see exactly how this page is working. So we do have up in our script tag there, which has an attribute type Java, text JavaScript, some special syntax placed there to indicate that we have JavaScript code here, which you always have to include. This left bracket bang C data with these JavaScript comments on the side to prevent the parser from looking at those tags. And then you'll note the syntax looks something like function, then the name of the function, and those empty parentheses indicating that this particular function does not take any parameters, much like a function in C would be written. Note that the difference between this and functions in C is we don't specify a return type, and we need not do that because if we do return anything, the type doesn't matter because this is a loosely typed language, and if we don't type return anything, then the return type is irrelevant. And you'll see here that this does, in fact, execute the function alert you clicked with the argument you clicked in the body. Nice, and does the same thing we had before, where down here we've set up our attribute with a function that we ourselves have written. Okay, so we're starting to see some more dynamic content in our web pages. We can start doing things with the user after the page has been loaded that are completely independent of reaching out to the internet and getting more content from the server. This is all happening in the context of the browser with the user after the page has been loaded. So that's kind of cool. It's another tool that we have available and allows us to craft the experience a little more closely. So that's sort of fun, but what else can we do? Can we get a little more interesting than this? We're just sort of executing this predetermined code that's sort of boring. It always does the same thing. We're just alerting the user this message, which we've already defined prior to ever having the user load the page. So can we do a little better? Can we make things a little more interesting? So let's consider whether we can pull information off of the page that we're currently on, such that if we have some sort of form on the page with which the user can fill out fields on, then maybe we can make use of that information and do something a little more dynamic and interesting. So the way we do that is by exploiting the document object model. So what is the document object model? Well, it's a data structure that's used by the web page to represent the contents of that web page. So after some HTML is loaded into the browser, it keeps track of all those different fields and the IDs, which you've added to them as attributes in those tags, as components of the document object model, and remembers where each of them is within the object model and the different attributes it has. And at any time, the browser can access any of those individual attributes, and if it likes, change them. So if you specify to the browser that it should change any of these using JavaScript, you're able to do so and change the page after it's been loaded. So this allows us to access individual elements in JavaScript by ID and get their contents as well as modify them. So this should be introducing you to sort of some thoughts about how you could change the web page after it's been loaded and the flexibility this gives you in crafting user experience. So an example of this would be writing a name, which is some variable, and assigning it to document.getElementById, providing this parameter name.value. So what do you suppose this does? What's it seem like it does? All right, so this is the sort of syntax we use to refer to elements that are contained within the document object model. So we first write document. That's like the root of the document object model. Everything in the document object model is contained within the document. Then dot, to get a little more specific, we get an element by its ID. So we have some element on the page which has its ID attribute set to name, presumably, and we're getting that element. And after we have that element, we can specify still further that we want the value attribute of that. So whatever the value attribute is of name, and if name is, for example, some text input on the page, like we use in HTML forms from last week, value is the contents of that, so the string that's currently there. So essentially what we're able to do is get the string out of the contents of this form and then store it in a variable in JavaScript. And then things get a little more interesting because then we can do whatever we want with it. So let's take a look at an example of something like that. Okay, so we have here another JavaScript page that prompts you for your favorite food and your favorite class. So let's say our favorite food is cookies. And does anyone have a favorite class that they'd like to shout out the name of? Okay, how about CSE52? I've heard that one's pretty good. So all right, so now we've entered in the contents of this form. We're promised that if we click on this sentence, we're going to be given an incredulous response. So that sounds interesting. So let's see what happens if I click on this. Oh, and I get another alert window. And this time, the message has actually been customized using content drawn from this web page. And it says, your favorite food is cookies and your favorite class is CSE52. And then there's an interrobang. So this is, in fact, incredulous. So it was implemented as per the specs. And just to show once again that there's a little bit of a JavaScript magic going on here with the DOM and that this isn't pre-scripted. If I change this to a steak and click on this, it does in fact change, and the message reflects the contents of the page as they currently are without ever having to reload the page. So it's just grabbing that information at runtime from the browser. Okay. So how did we do this exactly? Well, let's take a look at the JavaScript file and the HTML file, which contains the JavaScript, and sort of explore. Okay, so we see here we have these input tags, which we're used to seeing from implementing forms in HTML, except they're not contained within a form. They're just these input tags which don't have a form. They don't need to be included in a form because we're not actually submitting to another page. We're doing all of this on the same page. Their ID attribute has been set to text1 and text2 respectively. You see that text1 is used to store the favorite food of the user, while text2 is used to store their favorite class. You might have noticed that as soon as I loaded the page up, it contained the value cookies in the first tag. That wasn't something I typed before class. That was there when the page loaded. You'll note that there's a value attribute, which is not present in the second tag, in the first tag. So value is always an attribute which by default is included for an input element. But if you don't specify what it is previously, it just defaults to being an empty string. And that's why when you load a form, like a Google spreadsheet or something, all the forms are already empty because the value has not been specified. But if you type something, then it has a value attribute which contains whatever you typed. And likewise, we can specify what the value attribute is initially, and then we'll have that text already included within the form. Okay, so we see how we're creating these form elements, but let's look at something new. So now using this same onClick attribute or event handler in this case, we're passing in a string which contains multiple JavaScript statements this time. So first we're creating a local variable called food, var food equals document.getElementById, so just like the example on the slide, then getting specifically text1, then the value of that tag. So in this case it'd get cookies, I guess, in our initial run through of this. Then we're setting the variable class to be equal to document.getElementById text2.value, so getting the value out of that second text element. And then we're finally printing to the screen using alert, creating that alert window in JavaScript. Your favorite food is, then making use of this concatenation operator, linking in dynamically this string, which we've stored in this local variable, into the string, pasting it in there, and then printing out a custom message using content that was found elsewhere on our page. So that's kind of cool. It sort of shows how we can make use of the input the user has given us in order to do something interesting with our web page and change the contents of a JavaScript alert window. But we can actually do a little better than that, too. We can do things that are a little more cool because I'm showing how to use the document object model to store values which are currently found on the page. But we can actually change these values destructively as well by switching around the assignment so that we're actually placing new things within the value of some particular region of the page. So let's take a look at a slightly more interesting example, something that's a bit more involved that's going to show exactly the power of JavaScript to change the page environment. So what you're going to see is you'll see what you're going to see. But take note of how elements on the page are dynamically changing in order to create a unique experience that is a little different from the sort of web pages that we've been looking at. Okay. So we have here a Pokemon battle implemented in JavaScript. So initially we see here the message at the bottom of the screen is changing to reflect the current status of the battle. We said we released Charizard at first, and then it said a wild Alakazam appeared. This image of the Alakazam Pokemon appeared at a certain point in the music that was timed to happen exactly then. We have music simultaneously playing in the background of the page, hidden in some element that's not viewable, using CSS to style that in a certain way. And we also have these form buttons here, which presumably should do something, not in the same way form buttons do things that we've seen in previous examples, but by doing something dynamically on the page without reloading and submitting to another page. So let's see what happens if I use Fire Punch. Okay, so Charizard uses Fire Punch. It's super effective, and the wild Pokemon is defeated. Note that the music switches to the victory music, and the Alakazam disappears, as does its status information. Okay, so what we're essentially seeing is how JavaScript can interact with multiple components of the page without ever reloading anything and create this dynamic experience where we're able to add and remove elements on the fly within the browser without ever pulling in additional information or having to reload the page. So this is very encouraging because it shows how we can create a dynamic user experience in the user's browser without troubling them with having to reload the page or wait for their connection to be established with the server again and get this information back, which gives them a much more fluid experience and allows you to do something way more interesting on the web. So let's take a look at this example and sort of see some of the things I did to make this happen. So if I pull open Pokemon.php, it is in fact a PHP file, unlike the HTML files we've been using in other examples. So PHP is used to generate an HTML file, and the file generated in PHP can of course also contain JavaScript. PHP just happens to be used to dynamically generate this particular file, but the end output is formatted as HTML is, so it can also include some JavaScript. Okay, so, yes?
Your actions don't seem to work in Firefox. Just found that that was possibly a teachable moment.
Okay, so I actually am aware of that. I don't know how this is in Firefox. There are some discrepancies in how this... This particular JavaScript code is handled in other browsers. This is definitely something you want to watch out for in your problem sets to ensure you have widespread compatibility. So yes, it is in fact a teachable moment because although this works out to be what I would consider actually a fairly slick demo in Chrome, it does not work absolutely perfectly in Firefox, and it does have some bugs, particularly in the latest version of Firefox. So that is something you do want to tend to watch out for, and a student has been vigilant enough to point out to me now. But for now, we'll just go back and look at what does, in fact, work in Chrome, at least, and focus on how this was implemented in JavaScript. Okay, so we seem to have a lot of JavaScript code going on here. So let's just skip through this for now and come back to it as we find what each of those functions is responsible for. Okay, so body seems as good a place as any to start. So we have this onLoad attribute, which is another event handler we haven't seen previously. We've just been using onClick up until now. So onLoad calls some function called setTimeout, which takes as its argument what looks like another JavaScript function, Pokemon appears, and also a numerical value. Any idea what this might be doing? So you recall from the demo that Alakazam did not appear on the screen for about 5 seconds after we started up the demo, because we wanted him to appear right at that time when the sound effect played in the track that suggested that he'd been released. Okay, so what's actually happening here is I actually took the time to sort of work out how long I wanted the page to wait before it made Alakazam appear. And using setTimeout, I'm able to tell it the page that I want it to execute this code, but not yet. And I implemented actually a 5585 millisecond delay before the Pokemon would actually appear after the page loaded. And when the page loads, the music actually starts. So I essentially am able to implement a delay between the start of the music and the appearance of the Pokemon using this function. All right, so then following this, we're creating a table. We have some HTML comments indicating as is warranted, and a HTML page this lengthy and convoluted, just what each section of the page is responsible for and what part of the layout it's related to. Friendly Pokemon's row, pictures of different Pokemon, a bunch of IDs representing what different elements of the page are called so we can access them individually. We have these submission buttons contained here, which we have these attributes placed on, event handlers, so when we click on them, we call the attack function. So that allows us to end the battle by using one of Charizard's moves and passing in a value, or representing a value for whatever move that corresponds to. We have a message division here, which is that bottom row of the page, which contains the messages, sort of like on the bottom of the Game Boy screen that prints out that a wild Pokemon has been defeated or something like that. So this division has the message ID, so we can access that individually. We also have a div here called music, into which we embed an MP3 file. So it starts out as battle.mp3, which is the song we heard initially. It's that Pokemon battle song. The autoplay attribute is set to true, so as soon as the page loads, we start playing this song. Hidden is also equal to true. And this explains why we don't see some sort of MP3 player object contained on the page. We actually don't want to see that. We just want it to play music in the background, which is actually, in general, sort of annoying because it means that the user can't turn it off without adjusting their volume. But for the purposes of the demo, it sort of adds a layer of abstraction that allows us to simulate more closely the experience of the Pokemon battle itself, which is, you know, really what I was going for. So, all right, so we've taken a look at sort of how our HTML is laid on the page. So let's back up a little and see what we're actually doing in JavaScript. Okay, so we have this attack function. It's the goodest place I need to start. So, you know, here we have, let me back up a little bit. Okay, so we have a function here called message. And you may recall in the Sudoku problem set, you had a function available to you called showBanner that allowed you to print something on the screen. So you sort of have this layer of abstraction that allowed you to very simply print on some portion using end curses of your screen and just define a string. So similarly, I'm using this function to allow me to just abstract away what I'm doing here with the DOM and pass in a string, which then accesses the inner HTML attribute of the ID message and then sets that equal to the string I'm passing in. What is the inner HTML attribute? We haven't talked about this yet, but the name is very suggestive. Okay, so the inner HTML attribute actually corresponds to whatever HTML is contained within some division of the page. So if I create some division of the page and write in body text or something like that, the inner HTML attribute for that element of the page is set equal to body text and whatever tags or other content are placed there, maybe image tags representing some image that's placed there, whatever I like. And by modifying inner HTML, this is something very powerful you can do with the document object model. You can actually smash everything that's contained in that region of the page. So if I have 1,000 lines of text contained in some division and I set inner HTML equal to some string I pass in here that's just like, I like cookies or something, I just was able to smash that entire essay that I have on this HTML page and replace it with some string. So JavaScript using the document object model actually has nigh unlimited power to access different elements of the page and change them to contain whatever you want them to contain, which is what we're using in this demo to create this effective dynamicism, which is changing the entire user experience as we go. Also here we have the Pokemon appears function, which we call after a timeout of about 5,500 milliseconds. So we get an element on the page, which is one of the table cells, the upper right table cell where Alakazam appeared. We're changing the inner HTML here, so it now contains an image where once there was not. Then getting an element by ID that's enemy Pokemon stats, which is the box on the left that had Alakazam's name and hit points. And setting that to style.display equal block. So style, you recall, relates to CSS, so it allows us to set up some CSS formatting declarations for any particular division of the page and format them individually. By using a dot there and going a little bit deeper and going to display contained within style, we're able to define one of those particular formatting specifications in CSS for that tag. So presumably display had been set to none previously here. And now by setting it to block, I'm making it so that the contents of this division of the page are actually displayed. If that's confusing to anyone who's not familiar with that, a particular CSS attribute that's useful in our example we're using now is display. Display you can either set to none, so display equals none. So if I have some region of the page that contains, say, a picture, for example, and I set display equal to none, well, you can't see them because we're not displaying this element on the page. It's still there in the HTML. This image is contained in the document object model. The web browser can't access it if it wants to, but the formatting is set such that it's not going to display it. If we change this to block, then we do display it. Why is it called block? Any idea? Elements in an HTML page are rectangular. So we display the block. I'm not aware of anything you can do with CSS to display things in other shapes, though they might exist in the newer versions of CSS. The name suggests that functionality, if it's not there, might be there later. But all you really need to know now is none and block for display. It can be somewhat useful in these sorts of situations. Okay, so this example is somewhat interesting to crawl through just to point out specific things you can do with JavaScript, but not particularly all that useful to go all the way through since there is a lot of code happening and it's more meant as a visual example. I'll put this code up on the website, so if you are interested in some of the things happening with JavaScript here or if you just want to play around with it like I have been doing in front of you here, that'll be accessible to you. Any questions about any of the things we're seeing with JavaScript or the document object model here? Okay, so what we've been able to do so far is play around with actually a lot of flexibility with the contents of the page we're currently on dynamically and do things on the page without having to reload it using JavaScript. But what if we want to pull in information that comes from elsewhere? So using PHP on the last problem set, we were able to look up stock prices on Yahoo's servers, pull in this .csv file, while we're still generating the HTML page and then inlining that information in the page as we're creating it and then passing it to the user. But we can do something actually sort of similar after the page has been loaded, which means we can do it repeatedly and not just the one time when the page is loaded. So we could have something on the page that refreshes and reflects the current stock prices rather than having to go out or requiring the user to refresh the page if they want new information. All right, so how do we do that? Well, so far we've got these tools available to us, and we sort of need to introduce a new concept that makes use of JavaScript sort of in a novel way using different techniques. And this is called AJAX, Asynchronous JavaScript in XML. So AJAX is used to dynamically load content from other pages on the internet. So what does this look? What exactly do I mean when I talk about AJAX? Like I said, it's asynchronous JavaScript and HTML, and it is used to allow us to send requests to other pages on the net, on the web, without reloading the page and pull that into us. So how exactly do we do that? So including the slide, sort of a recipe for an AJAX call. It looks somewhat convoluted, and there are a lot of steps in creating one of these calls. But after you've done it once, it's easier to do it subsequent times because you can make use of the code you've already written or the code someone else has written if you just draw that in and make use of it and adapt it for your own purposes, and things get a lot easier after the first time. Okay, so let's take a look at an example of an AJAX call and explore exactly how it's working. So if I pull open this page here, we have some fields that are labeled operand 1, operand 2, and product. Okay, so it looks like this page is going to do some multiplication for me. So if I fill in a couple numbers in these operand 1 and operand 2 fields, like 17 and 19, so 153, I believe. Do the math. Wait. Oh, wow. Yeah, I was not thinking. Sorry. I was doing 17 times 9, save myself a little credibility. So 17 times 19, and we do, in fact, get 153 plus 170, which is going to give us 19 times 17, 323. And you'll note there, well, what just happened? That happened really quickly. So if we change this to some other number, do the math. Okay, so we very briefly saw this image appear that was animating, suggesting the page was doing something, sort of one of those tacky progress animations that we see with calls like this. And then this field over here immediately updated to reflect the product of the values that we just placed here. So you might be thinking, okay, no big deal. You were just doing some JavaScript, which performs some multiplication, and then use the document object model to fill in that field. Well, it's actually a little more complicated than that. Because you'll see here that I'm not actually executing any scripts which are going to do any multiplication. There's no multiplication operations on this page. And in reality, for this particular example, it'd probably be simpler if I just allowed the JavaScript to do the multiplication, since that's something JavaScript can do. But it's important to note that I'm sort of outsourcing work to another page on the internet. And while this operation is very simple, if I were doing something more complicated that I wanted to make use of the resources elsewhere to do, this is very useful. Or if I want to make use of data which is not accessible by me, for example, the contents of someone else's database, such as Yahoo's stock information, this could be very useful. And by setting up an interface like this, where I can just request the information and have the page updated for me using information elsewhere on the web, without reloading, I get a much more seamless design that's easier for the user to use and much more friendly. All right, so how is this happening exactly? Well, let's take a look at the code. Okay, so the first thing we do is create an XHR object. So what is an XHR object? Well, an XHR is an XML HTTP request. So we initially set this to null. And then we're going to, when we call the function multiply, which is called below when we submit our form, you'll note that the form has no action, so the contents of this form are not actually being passed to another page on the internet. We leave that empty. And our onSubmit event handler is set to execute multiply and then execute return false. Return false just prevents the form from attempting to submit to nothing, so we don't get an odd situation where the page tries to reload but has nowhere to go. Return false, just by convention, is what we put there to prevent that from happening. We call multiply here. So when we submit our information, multiply is called. So this is just something that's triggered when we press the submit button. And if we go up here, what happens when we call reply? Well, first we instantiate our XML HTTP request object. So for those unfamiliar with object-oriented programming, which you will be familiar with if you come to my Java seminar on Friday, we use this syntax to create an object of type XML HTTP request, just using this new keyword and these parentheses indicating we're not passing any parameters in the creation of this object. So if we want to create an XML HTTP request and store it at XHR, we just write XHR equals new XML HTTP request, and that takes care of that for us. Another idea that will be familiar to people who stopped by the Java seminar or who have used it previously is the idea of error catching. So this isn't something we've been using in C this year, but essentially what's happening here is we're trying to do something, and if we generate an exception, so if an error occurs that causes that to not succeed, we can catch that exception, catch that error, catch that E, and then instead we can set XHR equal to new ActiveX object, which takes as a parameter this strings. This is Microsoft.xml HTTP. So what does that mean? Why do we have to do this, you think? Are there any context clues there that might suggest why this is necessary? So not all browsers abide by the same standards, and one of those browsers happens to be Internet Explorer, which particularly, I believe, IE6 made use of these ActiveX objects as opposed to the XML HTTP requests, which later became the norm. So in order to support these legacy browsers that are still used, particularly by business enterprises, which for which it's very difficult to move forward using an entirely different set of software every so often, generally want to support pages like this instead of just generating an exception. So in the event that we're using a browser which cannot support an XML HTTP request, we create an ActiveX object. And fortunately, in this case, we can actually use those two objects in the same way. So we move forward similarly, just making this one change initially. However, if we're using a really old browser and we can't handle AJAX requests at all, then we just set XHR remains null, and we alert the user, if their browser supports JavaScript at least, that AJAX is unsupported and we're unable to do whatever we're trying to do. Okay, so now we've created this object that we can make use of. So what comes next? Okay. So now we have to construct the URL to which we're going to send our request. So first we need to get the values that we want to pass, our parameters. So we use the document object model to get our two operands, which we've denoted x1 and x2 in their ID attributes below on the page, if you recall. We get their values and store them in these JavaScript variables x and y. And then we construct our URL using these concatenation operators that look something like this. Ajax helper 2.php, a file I've created that lives in the same folder. Question mark x equals the value of x, ampersand y equals the value of y. Does that look familiar? Why are we constructing the URL in this particular way? It seems a little reminiscent of something we've done previously. What is this URL? It represents passing these parameters to the URL using get. So you recall we had two different methods by which to pass information using a form. We could either pass using post, which hid the information in the HTTP packet, or we could use get, which just broadcast that information in the URL. So essentially what happens when you submit using get is you just navigate to this page and include all your parameters in the URL. So rather than submitting using a form using get, we can actually just go to this page and type the parameters there, and we'll get the same result. And this is why you can go on Google and search for pumas, and then you copy the search query and send your friend on your instant messenger a link to this web page which contains all these search results about pumas, and then you guys can have a nice chat about fun facts about jungle cats, I guess. Yeah, and you get exactly the same request sent to the Google servers, and your friend gets the same response sent back to them because this get request is encapsulated within this URL. Okay, so then let's actually step out of here for a moment and take a look at Ajax helper 2.php. So, okay, this is really simple. It's not even actually a proper web page. It's just some PHP code that outputs some result. And you'll note here that it just echoes out get x times get y. So it takes these two parameters that are being passed in by the get request and then just spits out their product. So we're essentially just outsourcing a multiplication operation. And what this PHP code ends up outputting is a text file that only contains the product of the two numbers. And that's what we end up pulling out from this web page and then storing in one of those fields on our other page. And we'll see how that's done in just another moment. So something I've elected to do aesthetically, if you can call it that, is getting an element by ID progress, which contains that animated GIF that just does the annoying very web 2.0 animation, with just this blue and black spiral, indicating we're loading something on the page. We set the display setting to block, so we're now showing it. Then as we send out the object, the XML HTTP request to Ajax helper 2.php, we have to do a few more things. We set on ready state change, which is an event handler that detects different changes in the ready state, as it were, of the XML HTTP request, which ranges from 1 to 4, each indicating a different status of the request having been made and being fulfilled. All you really need to know is that when the ready state is 4, it means it's been fully loaded and you're ready to use the data. But we do have to check on that every time the ready state changes because we never know when we're going to finally get that 4. Then we open the request, indicate that we're using a get request, include the URL, and include this Boolean true. If you look up these functions, you can find out more information about what's happening with these parameters. I can tell you that Boolean represents that this is an asynchronous call, so essentially an Ajax call. So it's not something we're going to wait on. We're just going to have it be done off to the side and then return whatever it feels like it. And then xhr.send null to finally send the request off to the server and get things done. All right, so let's also take a look at handler, since we're apparently executing this whenever the ready state changes. So the first thing we do is check to make sure the ready state is equal to 4. If it's not, we're not ready to do anything yet, and we quit. But if it's finally 4, the request has been loaded. We first hide our stupid progress bar, because we've finished up with our Ajax call, and we don't want to show it anymore, because we're ready to show the user the result of the Ajax call. And then if xhr.status equals 200, what does that mean? What might that mean? So we just send out a request to a web page on the internet, and what we're checking if the status is equal to 200. Yeah, so you might be used to seeing numbers like 404 appear on your browser, like 404 file not found, 403 forbidden, 500 internal server error, I believe. You might not be used to seeing 200 because 200 means everything went well and you aren't likely to see an error message that tells you that thing went well. You just see the contents of the web page. So we first check whether or not our request was, in connecting to the page, we're able to actually access it. If it's 200, then what we do is we set the value in the ID product, which is going to contain the product of the two elements we've passed in, equal to xhr.responseText. So responseText just contains whatever output we were able to get from that PHP file. And since you recall it was just a text file that contained the product of those two numbers, because that's all that PHP file output, we can just take that responseText in full and assign it destructively to the value of this product element. So we're able to change the contents of that so that it replaces whatever was there before, either a blank string of the product of some other two numbers we did before, with the new product of the two numbers that we've passed in using our AJAX call. And if that doesn't work, we alert the user that there's been an AJAX fail. All right. And just to look at this again once more to appreciate it, in the space of just some milliseconds, I guess, we type in some mathematical operation, hit this button, it's going to send out a packet across the internet, sending these two parameters to some other web page. That page is going to run a PHP interpreter, which is then going to perform a mathematical operation, send that information back to us on this page, and then we'll use the dynamic the document object model with JavaScript in the context of our web browser to change the contents of the page dynamically. And voila, there's our product. So that's AJAX. You should find it to be very useful if you do a web-based project. It allows you to create an interface which is a lot more intuitive and easy to use than just traditional forms using PHP and HTML. So hopefully you found that helpful. These examples will all be placed online either tonight or tomorrow. So if you want to draw on them for any projects you work on in the future, those will be available for you. Any questions on anything we've seen today? All right, great. Well, that concludes our last substantive section for the year. We'll be back next week for quiz one review. So good luck with the problem set, and I'll see you all then. Thanks.